Howard Covington in an interview with Herbert Hyde on January the 27th at 10 a.m. in his office in Asheville, North Carolina. Mr. Hyde, tell me where you were born and when.
Swain County, north of Bryson City, in a little one-room cabin on December 12, 1925, right in the middle of a blizzard and a snowstorm, they said.
Now, you told someone one time that your grandmother said your house was built with, made a cabin built out of scantlings.
Scantlings.
Scantlings. How do you spell that?
S-C-A-N-T-L-I-N, apostrophe S, or L-I-N-G-S is what it should be.
Right.
It's small, well, it was, the cracks were covered with those. That's the small, thin little boards that you get at a sawmill, what we used to call a peckerwood sawmill. You know, that's the circular kind. You'd see them all around the country. And you use those if you put up a house that's just planks, say 12 inches wide, and you nail them. They're up and down to the roof. Then there would be little cracks between them. And you get this little thin piece of lumber called a scantling, that's the way they pronounce it. And you tack that on the outside to keep the wind from blowing the snow in on your feet, which happened to me a few times.
You had a large family.
Yes.
You came from a large family.
Yeah.
How many brothers and sisters?
Five boys and two brothers. Five boys and two girls lived to be grown. Two little children, two little girls died when very, very young. My younger sister, Helen, died at four, just 2 years younger than I. She fell and hit her head and died from that. And another sister, Mary Alice, when she was only 3 weeks old or something like that. But seven of us are still living.
And tell me about your father.
My father was Irving Marcus Hyde, named for his two grandfathers, Irv Hyde and Mark Penland. He was born there in 1903. He was born on a farm, raised back in the mountains, went through the third grade, was an axeman, that's what they called him back then, in lumber crews. They'd go out, I guess he started when he was 14, down in the Hazel Creek section of Swain County. When the logging companies came from up north, they'd finished out in Canada and Michigan and those places, and they came to the southern Appalachians to start logging. And he was an axeman, used a double-bitted axe, and they would chip the front part of a tree the way it's going to fall. And then the two men with a saw would saw the back part, and it'd fall, and then they'd saw it up and get it out. That's what he worked as a farmer and in logging crews most of his life.
Was this a time when the mountains were being pretty heavily cut over? Was there
yes,
a major
yes, it was.
Business?
It was. It's all over. The company that came into the lower part of Swain County, there was a little village there named Proctor, and I guess it had up to 1,500, 2,000 people. So it was just nothing to begin with. In fact, it was named after my great-granddaddy's, well, my great aunt's husband, Bill Proctor. And 5 miles up the creek was a little place called Medlin. That was my great-great-grandfather, Medlin. And he ran a post office, a little store, and they named the little village after whoever ran it. And that, down where he lives, is one house to start with in the post office. And then it built up to that many people. Sawmill there. It's still, you can see some sign of it, though it's about all gone. Same thing happened in Macon County later. That same company moved over to Rainbow Springs. Now there's only one house that you'll see there along U.S. 64 from Franklin to Hayesville. But at that time, I was over there in 28 when I was three, and I could see houses on the hillside and lumber pile everywhere. There's about 1,500 people there, and there's one house left today. Above Canton on the river there, the Pigeon River, the same kind of thing, and Champion all over the Smokies. That was going on. It was a big deal, and they got most of the lumber. There's some virgin timber left, notably Joyce Kilmer Forest in Graham County. And I used to work for the Forest Service after I got out of World War II, cruising timber and surveying, and I've been to spots, other places where I could tell you there's virgin timber. Well, they couldn't get to it, you know, rock cliffs. There's some Nantahala Gorge on the north side. There's poplar trees in there 7 and 8 feet through in diameter. Most people never saw any like that.
Was that the size of the timber that was being cut?
The poplar. And chestnuts were big. Mm-hmm. Of course, they started dying in the 20s. I remember when they were full of chestnuts, and you could see them up high and all of that, and the hogs would eat them, and we'd gather them and all that business. Mm-hmm. But they were up to 7 and 8 feet through at the butt, and seemed like 100 feet tall to me, way up to the first limb, that kind of thing. I've got a picture of some men in Graham County, and they're standing near a tree before they cut it, and you see by the height of them that the tree is the diameter is as great as their height, or a little more so. Now, the oaks would get up to 5 feet, something like that. Hickory's not as much, but red oak particularly. But there's all kinds of oak, red oak, black oak, white oak, post oak, you know, chestnut oak. Chestnut oak's what you get tan bark from, to tan. And they got that out. Even when I was a boy, we used to get out tan bark. Had a tanning yard over at Andrews, and they'd haul it over there and tan cowhides, you know, make leather, that kind of thing. Chestnut was used. You could get the tannic acid out of the chestnut and out of the bark of chestnut oak and hemlock, although we used hemlock bark. We used to have a lot of dogs, and in the summertime they'd get the mange, and they'd take the hair off of them, you know, and it's pretty bad, and they'd spread it through the whole gang of dogs. And I'd see Dad heading for a hemlock tree with his axe. I knew what he was going to do. He was going to cut that tree and skin the bark off, put it in a big black pot that we used to boil clothes in, boil that, and then dip the dogs in it and turn them loose. You had to do that, kind of like turning loose a hornet or real quickly, because they'd eat you up. They'd jump and hit the ground 15 feet away and holler. There's a gap of the mountain leading toward the Tuckasegee River. They could see that line. They'd head through that and head for the river. About 3 days they'd come back, but they'd be healed up and hired over, ready to go. You didn't need all that, did you?
No, that's part of, well, you know, listening to you in the legislature over the years, you always would have some tale about growing up or experience about living in the mountains, and I think that's, you know, that's part of this culture, obviously, that needs to be preserved. You were talking about in the 20s, you were born in the 20s.
25.
Growing up in the 30s, was the Depression?
Yes.
Did it change life in the mountains, or was the more things so poor at that point that it really didn't make much difference?
Well, it's a little difficult for me to answer that with authority, because having born 25, and 29 came, and the market crashed and all that, although it hit here in Asheville and some of these places, banks went under earlier. But I wasn't fully aware of being the kid I was. I was not fully aware of just what the culture was or the way of living or making livings. Although my opinion is that it was largely the families outside the towns, at least, grew their own crops, raised their beef, raised a hog, raised chickens, things of that kind, and pretty well furnished their own food, and depended very little on buying anything. And that if they did anything extra, it was cutting wood, like railroad cross ties, or tannic acid, or what we later called acid wood, we'd send over to Champion. Different things, and some of them called telegram poles, telephone poles, really what they were. I remember one fella, Mr. Hall, had been getting out some poles, and some fella asked his son how many he had out, and he said, well, he just likes a few of having several. I don't know quite how many that could be, but at any rate, they did that, and that continued during the Depression. I guess we were all poor, but we didn't really think of it, because everybody's pretty much the same. Everybody that lived out of the country. Now they're doctors or lawyers' children in Bryson City, and that's, gosh, I didn't get to Waynesville till that far east when I was 16. I did get over to Rainbow Springs that time, and I went to Tennessee a number of times because one of my aunts, my grandmother Hyde's daughters, lived over on Walling Creek where Dolly Parton's from, and we go visit them. She had a brother, my grandmother had a brother who drove a taxi cab, and he'd take us over on a weekend. We'd spend a weekend with my aunt. Or sometimes go over into Tennessee. My grandmother on the other side had a brother over there in Townsend, Tennessee. We'd go visit there. I remember going across Fighting Creek Mountain and things like that in that area. But except for that, and there was, I guess I could see some effect of the Depression, but everybody's pretty much in the same boat. Everybody depended on themselves to make a living, and pretty well did it.
What about schooling?
Well, when I first started, there was a little one-room, one-teacher school at a place called Epp Springs, which is at the mouth of Peachtree. It's now in the Smoky Mountain National Park. It's right on the edge of the Tuckasegee River. This is about 5 or 6 miles west of Bryson City, on the way to Fontana, where the dam is. And Ms. Woodard taught there. And I went there a while as a one-teacher, one-room, seven-grade school. There was another like school at the head of Lands Creek, and we lived on Lands Creek. It flowed into the Tuckasegee. And it had, again, seven grades, one room, one teacher. I remember the teacher, he lived over near Alm on our Lueta, which is west of Bryson City, and he had a car, and he'd drive through Bryson City and up Bryson Branch as far as you could get. It's a dirt road, and he'd park out of Mr. Cochran's, then walk across the mountain and teach, and he was a good teacher. I liked him. But I'd gone there a while, and we lived closer to Bryson City, and I'd gone there a while in the first grade, and then we switched and went to Epp Springs, then to Lands Creek, and then I asked my dad if it's all right if I walked out to Bryson City. He said, well, if you think you can stand the snow and ice. So I started walking through the snow and ice for 11 years. That's 4 miles each way. But my older brother and I and one other young man on Lands Creek are the only three that ever walked out of there. The rest of them went to that seventh grade school and then stopped. Nobody ever went to high school. And many of them didn't even finish seventh grades. But, well, my brother went through the ninth and joined the CCCs. That's when it came in. And the other young man, he quit about the seventh, as I recall. So I was the only one walking out through high school.
Why did you want to do that? What was your motivation for
it? I don't know. They some of my classmates, I see them occasionally. We had our 50th high school reunion recently, and two or three accused me of always having my head stuck in a book. I don't know why they said that. But they also, I'd forgotten it, but they put me down as the most likely to succeed and the Sherlock Holmes of their class.
I don't know.
I guess just being curious about things, looking into them.
Did you have access to books
when
you were a youngster?
Yeah, two. The Bible and Sears Roebuck catalog. We had those at home. Mm-hmm. My mother would go to town. Mom had gone through the eighth grade. And now on her side, the family's pretty well educated. In fact, my great uncle, her uncle, Thomas J. Buchanan, taught at Wake Forest, taught religion for 50 years, retired and came home. He was the first native of Swain County ever to finish college. I didn't know that for many years, and I found it in a book on the history of education that Mrs. Thompson wrote later on. But my grandfather Madeline was fairly well educated. Not college, I don't mean that, but they were sensible and they could read and understand. My grandmother Hyde and grandfather Hyde were both illiterate. And granddad never learned to read, but grandma, she raised her big family. She taught herself to read and write. And then she'd sit down and read the Bible to granddad, grandpa. He had a good memory. He'd memorize 8 chapters at a time. And he was a deacon in the local Baptist church, even though illiterate. But that preacher would get up and quote, he'd better not misquote, because granddad would get all over him, you know. And
he would memorize this from listening to his wife.
Yes.
Read the Bible.
She'd read it one time, and he'd have 8 chapters, just give it back to you. Which is pretty good.
That's remarkable.
Yeah. But most of the people, you know, grammar grade, park grammar, most of them were not even through the seventh grade that I grew up with. Most kids on the creek, and many of them, mm-hmm, never finished.
You came of age or graduated from high school during the war.
Right.
And went into the Navy.
Correct.
How did you choose the Navy? Why did you choose
the Navy? It was the feeling throughout the mountains. There may have been a few here and there. They wanted to be 4F and not go. I remember when I went in, they took us down in South Carolina to an Army base and examined us, this, that. There were four of us. One, I was one. There was a young man that worked down at Fontana Dam. They was building that then. And a preacher and a felon had been convicted of some felony. And they didn't take him. They didn't take the preacher. I remember the preacher kept saying, oh, his wife would dismiss him so much, and tears would run down his cheeks. Well, they didn't take him. That was not, you didn't see him often trying to keep him going. Most of them wanted to go, the young men. And I wanted to go, and I had uncles and cousins, but I had I had him killed. My dad's only living brother then, Horace, killed on Normandy. Two cousins in Tennessee, both wounded terribly, and they're both dead now. Cousin, another first cousin, lived up in Virginia, was killed, another wounded. And just all over the place. And Mom knew that. And my older brother volunteered, went in the Navy, and she wouldn't sign up for me. You know, if you get your parents signed, you go in if we were 18. If you're 16, she wouldn't do it. So I worked a while surveying that summer, and then went down to Gaston County, where my grandfather Hyde was then living. I had aunts down there and moved down there to get work during the 30s. And got me a job in a spinning mill. Worked 6 weeks till I was 18. Then I was 18, I volunteered. I went in. They ran me through boot camp, and then I got into radio school to be a radio man. Then they sent me to school up in Maryland. Put me in naval intelligence, is what they called it. They'd broken the code of the Japanese, and we copied that down and decoded their language, and that's what I did over in the Pacific. I flew mostly from place to place because I had the big equipment. I was in Melbourne, Australia, New Guinea, Hawaii, Guam, and I was on other places, Wake and Midway, places like that, but it was where they had big equipment. They couldn't get aboard ship. They could now, I'm sure, but it's for copying all these messages and that kind
was
of thing.
Did you have a choice? It was the Navy or the Army or whatever?
Yeah, I volunteered. I asked to go in the Navy.
The Navy have, did it have an aura about it or a suggestion that you might see some things or be some places that you wouldn't be otherwise?
I think mostly because my brother was in it, and he's already over the Pacific. He got more battle stars than anybody I ever saw. I think he fought in about every battle they had over there. I think he's got 10 battle stars. And his was the first ship that went in Tokyo Bay ahead of the Missouri, by the way. The San Juan went in, just check it out, make sure that didn't shoot General MacArthur or that kind of thing, you see. So he had it.
What was your rating?
I was a third-class petty officer. I never got very high, but...
So you were were you taking coded messages, decoding them?
We were copying the Japanese messages. And my job was to copy them. They had they had the code, and the others were then decoding them and then handing them back to us. Or in many cases, we were sending them on to Washington. They had this, now we had to type it, and I could back then type about 80 words a minute I had two different 24-hour shifts. I guess during the Philippine invasion was one of them. That's on 24 hours, then four off, and then back again. And you had these, it came in on a tape that came in about 600 words a minute. And you put it, and it had this little wheel to pull the tape through, and you read it as you went and typed it out in five characters, you know, as you went. And after about 24 hours, I'd look up, and the waist scans would be walking around the walls, you know, that kind of gets you. But that was mostly what it was. It wasn't any big deal. It's just a matter of doing it and going your way. I remember on Guam, one thing, though, I was there and the war ended. And shortly after I got there, they had dug out and put these Quonset huts in so we could live in them. And we were about 3 miles from our station and drove us there in a truck because the Japs were still all around in the jungle. And so they had to have guards and all that business. Any rate, they dug out these holes and it came one of those Pacific storms and rain like the dickens just filled up every hole there was there. And it wasn't long till the frogs laid eggs and they hatched. And those son of them started raising cane at night. Well, I'd be 8 hours getting that beeping through my temples all day. And then at night I couldn't sleep for those things. So I organized me about a 300-member volunteer squad. And we went out with rocks and so on. We killed every frog there was around there. And that was fine that night. It was quiet. But then the next morning, about 110 degrees temperature by noon, they were smelling. They sent the admiral over, raised in hell, and lined us up. I won't know who it was. Nobody told anything. We just went on the way. They sent the bulldozers in, covered all the holes up, so we was all right then. You didn't want to get into these poor tales. Let's leave those alone.
That's interesting. What did you think of Franklin Roosevelt?
Great man. Great
did
man.
Did you know about him? Did people talk about
Oh, yeah.
Roosevelt?
Certainly. Oh, I used to listen to him. Yeah, once I got access to a radio, I'd hear him on his broadcast, you know, that he had his fireside chats, and would read about him and hear about him. Now, my family was split up. There were Republicans and Democrats. And that came, of course, that goes all the way back to the war between the states. My family was split up then. Some on one side, brothers on each side, and that kind of thing. The mountains were that way. But I like Roosevelt. And matter of fact, that's what made me a Democrat, looking back at what he did and realizing it from the time he was elected.
What about your mother and father? What was their persuasion?
They really didn't take any interest in politics. I guess mother's side of the family were mostly Republican. And my granddaddy Hyde, my dad's dad, was Republican. Matter of fact, I heard him make a statement one time. It was when Roosevelt was first elected. I tell this story in political meetings about how I came to be a Democrat. I heard him say to my daddy, he said, all those black folks voted for Roosevelt and ought not to do that. He said, after all, we freed the slaves. He's talking to Republicans. Well, that bothered me because I had this hero. He was a black preacher. I've got his picture at home, by the way. I kept it in headquarters down in Raleigh. I thought he was 9 feet tall and 4 feet wide. Reverend Mr. John Ritchie lived over at Tomatla in Cherokee County.
At where?
Tomatla. It's right near Murphy. That's a Cherokee name. Tomatla. Tomatla. We had a family graveyard or a community graveyard, Washington graveyard, where my ancestors were buried. And every Decoration Day, that's a week before Memorial Day, we'd go up there and, well, we'd clean it off and put flowers on it, and then we'd go for Decoration Day. And after we went there in the morning, they'd get out under the trees. You take your dinner with you, have dinner on the ground. The white folks, there's about half whites and half blacks in that cemetery. And the white folks have these preachers, three or four, and they'd preach. Then in the afternoon, the blacks brought theirs. They brought Mr. Ritchie from up to Tomatla each year. He'd come and they'd circle around him, the blacks would, and I couldn't see him, being little, 6 years old, seven. So I'd climb a tree like Zacchaeus did, you know, when Jesus came by and he climbed to see him. I'd climb this oak tree and I'd hang there. Well, he'd preach and he'd hit the line of a spiritual or religious song and they'd stop and they'd all sing it and they'd sway when they did. And there I'd be mesmerized just completely and almost fall out of that tree I'd have to hang on. Every time he'd tell us so that in the end, when that day came, that we was going to meet Jesus in the clouds. That we was going to rise out of those graves. We was going to be all resting white. And we was going to meet Jesus in the clouds. And I could just see it, you see, happening. So when my granddad said that, that bothered me. So I thought, I'll wait till the decoration. I'm going to ask the preacher. So we got up and preached, and he ran through it, same thing. I got down, wearing overalls, no shirt, barefooted. I followed him, and he had on a suit and a tie. And I pulled him by the coattail, and I said, preacher, I've got to ask you something. He stopped, and I told him what my granddad said. Well, he stopped there, and he knelt down on one knee in that red clay dust. Laid that big left arm around my shoulder, said, see down there, son, we're all sleeping together. Some of these days, we're going to glory. And that day of jubilation, Jesus is going to come in the cloud, and we're going to go meet him. We're all going to heaven, and when we do, we're all going as Democrats. So I've been a Democrat ever since that day. Part of that was Roosevelt, of course.
Did you have a radio in your home?
No, Granddad Medlin had one with seven batteries. You know, start big ones down to the little ones. And Tom Lowe had one down at his house where he ran a corn mill. My Aunt Annie once asked me if, she kidded me about that for years, if Tom Lowe really had a radio. And I said, well, I don't know, Aunt Annie. My dad said he did, but I ain't seen it. So I should have taken my dad's word. But at any rate, we eventually got one, yes. And I could hear Roosevelt in his speeches.
One thing is the part you said that you called it Decoration Day.
Yes. It's different from Memorial Day. Other people have Memorial Day. That's when they go to the graveyard. We call it Decoration.
Was that Decoration Day because of the war? I mean, was this a...
No. This had nothing to do with the war.
This was a church?
Community. This was community. And it came... It didn't come on Memorial Day. It came 1 week away from Memorial Day. Had nothing to do with it. Well, I guess it was like Memorial Day, but we call it Decoration Day. It's the day you went and decorated the graves with flowers. And we took natural flowers, but they also made them out of white crepe paper, or a different color crepe paper. They'd take scissors and they'd scoop them out, like make roses and all, and just fill them all up. Most of them were made, the flowers were, not natural.
But this was a common cemetery.
Yes. Community cemetery.
One side white, one side black, or were they intermingled?
No, you're right. Mostly one side black and one side white. There were a few Indians, only three or four, but a few Cherokees.
Were there many blacks living in the mountains?
No, most of those that lived in Swain County lived right there in Bryson City. I don't remember any. Yeah, there was one, lived out on Peachtree. Now, that's in the Smoky Mountain National Park now. An old man and his wife and one daughter. I can't remember their names, but I remember seeing them walk into town. The daughter never married. He could remember the days of the war between the states. The old man could. He's real old. Cook was their name. That's what it was, Cook. I've been by their house on Peachtree. But the most of them then lived at the northwestern edge of Bryson City. And they had a little school there, their own. I don't know whether it even included high school. I can't remember that well. But I remember, and I knew them, and my dad, and we got along with them. I never saw much difference. I didn't see the people treat them much different, other than, you know, segregated like they were in their community and in a school. But they visited us, and Dad used to trade dogs with them. They used to fox hunt together and all kinds of things like that. Old man Will Howell, I remember him. Will Howell had a daughter named, I thought her name was Aunt Barry. And her daughter is now living and corrected me not long ago to tell me her name was Elvira. But everybody out there could pronounce it Aunt Barry because we all knew her. She was a niece of this Reverend Mr. Ritchie. And I remember being down in Bryson City to make a political speech once, and the clerk of court had me up to the head table, was going to introduce me. And I looked back, and here's this black lady and two little boys. They were her grandnephews, I think. And I said, "Who is that?" She told me, she said, "That's Barry Howell's daughter." And I said, "Why?" She lived here in Asheville for 30 years, retired, gone back to her old home place. Well, it turned out this was her great uncle, that preacher. And I thought, I told that story everywhere in the state except in Swain County, and I thought, well, I'd like to tell it, but I wanted to make sure she wouldn't be offended. You know, you want to be careful about it. But I went back and told her briefly what it. She wanted me to tell it. She was delighted. And she's the lady that gave me his picture. She said, "You know, I found his picture other than the attic, and I'd like to give it to you." And I said, "Well, take it down to the clerk of court, and I'll pick it up." And she did, and I took it down here to a framing place and had it framed. It's a good picture. He's not 9 feet tall, and he's not 4 feet wide, but...
And what, tell me his name again,
suppose. John Ritchie.
Howell?
No. The preacher was John Ritchie. Oh. And old man Will Howell is the man who had he married Ritchie's sister, I guess, because he had the daughter Elvira, whom we called Aunt Barry. Will Howell used to, they used to have chicken fighting. I don't know if it was legal or not. I never were. Well, even making liquor back one time was legal, you know, until they came along and said you had to pay taxes on it. Of course, the only reason we made liquor was so you could carry 8 gallons of liquor, but you couldn't carry 8 bushels of corn. You just got a gallon from bushels. It's a matter of transportation. Folks didn't understand that. At any rate, we able to find chickens, and they come out to our place up above the barn on summers, fall, late in Saturday afternoon. I remember once he bought this white game rooster. And he bet a dollar on it. This in the Depression, that's big money. And he put steel spurs on them and wrapped them. They had a leather string to wrap them around legs and tie knot. And set them down, they'd face each other. And one of them would rear back and crow. Then he'd hop up in the air and make those heels, spin them around. And then the other one would do the same thing. And then they went at each other. This is the routine. I learned that as a boy. But he set down his white new game rooster, and the other fellow set down his. The other one crowed and hopped up in the air. And that looked at him and turned and ran to the field. He was 84 years old. He ran that chicken down, grabbed it by its neck, and wrung its head right there. If it wouldn't fight, he wouldn't keep it. He was a grand old fella.
Did the Republicans, when you were growing up, have any particular heroes?
Yes. Of course, they pretty well controlled politics in Swain County. I remember most of the people I remember being elected were Republican. The sheriff, Mr. Goldie Ferguson, I talked about him in the speech I made on the floor of the House about the Swain County custody speech. He's the man that saved Swain County from that bill, and he's Republican. And
how did you spell his first name? I was listening
to
that last night.
I think they spell it G-O-L-A. They spelled it wrong in the state book where they copied my speech. They spelled it G-A-L-A. I think it's Gola, but we pronounce it Goldie Perks. Mm-hmm. Now, he is born and raised over here in Buncombe County, in Sandy Mush, and his folks, there's a farm out there, and I think the old family home may still be there. In fact, his son, Luther Ferguson, still living here. It was a school teacher and principal out here at Sand Hill Elementary School where my children went. Too much from what we're talking about.
That's part of the story. I mean, a lot of people in North Carolina, I don't think, realize that the Republicans have held forth with some authority in certain sections of North Carolina.
Oh, yes, they certainly did. In the mountains, and Madison County, of course, until E.Y. Ponder was elected sheriff for 100 years, something like that. And then in Swain, I remember the first sheriff I recall was Joni C. Jonah. Had a brother named Noah. I don't know how they came along doing that. Jonah, Noah, and all that. Noah drove a taxi. And I remember my uncles on my mother's side were great friends of Mr. Ferguson. And they talked, and they were in favor of Herbert Hoover. He was a hero to them. I never heard much about. Well, I had a cousin named Warren Calvin Coolidge Frazier. I guess that tells you something. He picked up the nickname while he was Marines in World War II. Smokey, that's much better, maybe. He's still living. He's a good fellow.
Were these Republican connections long-standing traditions coming out of that Civil War heritage?
Yes. That's where it came from. That's where the split was. And those, of course, there were few slaves in the mountain. There were some. There were people here in Asheville and different places around who used them, but they didn't have a great use for them, you see, to begin with. And then folks weren't wealthy, not many. So apparently you didn't see much of that. And, of course, their being here, they're a vestige of that to some degree, but very little. And my folks, at least, none of my people ever, my kin folks ever, I doubt that any of them were ever in favor of slavery or thought it was right or anything else.
Did the Republicans have any aspirations during that time of being electing a governor?
They were always trying. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Were there legislators being elected from the mountains?
Yes, sir. Republican legislators, yes, sir.
In fact, you said the
Goldie Ferguson was 1913. I know that. And I later on now, Mr. Browning was elected to the state senate, and this would have been in the late 30s. He was Democrat, because I know knew his daddy, and I know one of his grandnephews and people mm-hmm. like that. But it was mixed.
After you got out of the war, came back home, you went back in the timber business.
Yes, I worked with my uncle, this Warren Calvin Coolidge Frazier's daddy and him, with Smokey and his daddy and I. First I came back and I had some friends that were going to college on the GI Bill. I'd just been home from Guam about 10 days. And three of them, classmates of mine in high school, are all set to go to the University of Tennessee, and they're going to drive over and stay a week and come back. And so I went over and I wanted to be a surveyor because I'd done some of that work. So I went over and took surveying and mathematics and mechanical drawing and that kind of thing for one quarter. And then, that was along about June of 46, I got out and I started working with my uncle and my cousin. We were hauling what we call stave bolts. That's white oak cut into lengths of about 4.5 to 5 feet, split. And you haul those to where they make barrels, make staves out of them and crook them, you know. Well, we hauled them from from many different places over to a mill in Macon County at what they call Cowee. Cowee is about 7 miles north of Franklin. There's a Cowee Creek. And that's where they do the ruby mining and all that on Cowee Creek in Macon County. That's where Wedgwood Pottery, back in the late 1600s, they sent over here and they discovered that, and they dug out a whole lot of that and put it in leather bags, or saddlebags, where you could lay it over an oxen's back. And they had about 200 of those, and they took it to Charleston and put it aboard ship and sent it to England, and Wedgwood made his finest pottery out of that. That's kale and clay. And North Carolina mountains, Mitchell County, Macon, Swain, and the Sierra Nevadas and the Ural Mountains of Russia are the only places in the world you'd find that, you see. At any rate, that's Cowee, and that's where we'd haul the stables. We'd pick them up in places like, if you were to go up Maggie Valley through Haywood County to the Gap, Soco Gap, and turn right on what's now the Blue Ridge Parkway, and go around and you go through a gap, we'd pick it up over there where they'd cut it. Or there's a road that nobody, hardly anyone ever heard of, but you can get in Swain County right there at Whittier, and you go up Conledge Creek, and you can go across a gap at that point and down to Cowee. And in that Leatherman Gap, it's called, they cut some there. Just different isolated places. In addition, we hauled heavy lumber, like 2 inches thick and 12 inches wide and, say, 16 feet long, great big pieces of it out of Clay County. We'd haul that, and from Macon County, over to Bryson City and load it on boxcars, and they'd ship it off somewhere. So it was that kind of thing. It was hauling. It wasn't cutting the timber. It was hauling it mostly.
Mm-hmm. What were you? Was this on trucks?
Or? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. And then that fall, I went to Franklin and started living there. Well, though, first, I'll tell you about this. This is mountain tradition. In the old days when I was growing up, many farmers would raise cane. I don't mean raise hell. They'd raise cane in a field and make molasses. Well, to do that, you gathered the fodder, the blades off of the stalk, just like you would off of corn, and they could use it for cattle feed. You take that off first, and then the seeds are at the top, a great big head. You'd cut that off. And then you would, two people would do it. One would hold the top of the cane, the other take a mowing blade, it's a good way to cut it off right at the ground, and lay it in the sled, haul it to where you're going to use it. There you had a cane mill, and it was just two rollers, and it's operated, and it had a big log across the top here, long piece out toward the tip and a shorter piece here, and you hooked a mule to it, and he went in a circle all day long, 12, 14 hours. And a man there putting the cane in, and it'd run through those rollers, and the juice would come out and go in the tub. And you took that, and you put it in a boiler, and you had to keep that fire going on, and you had to run a boiler had planks across the top of it, didn't reach all the way over to the side, and another one going this way, not quite the side, and you'd have to run that and skim it, take the stuff off the top, and boil it just right, and then pour it out into a container, sometimes a tub or a big bucket or a barrel, and then later you put it in gallon jugs, glass, once it cooled. Well, that fall, after I'd been working all summer hauling stables and so on, my brother had bought my granddad's old home place. It's on Lance Creek, and it's surrounded by the Smoky Mountain National Park on three sides. They got all of that except his, Lloyd's place in Lance Creek. So, and my brother was doing things there, farming and so on, bought some mules. Dad had this cane patch. It wasn't a very big one. He said, well, we ought to make syrup. So we got us a cane mill, got everything, got to going. And my older brother and a younger brother were working, and Dad was supervising. We was doing such a good job that he went off and bought two more fields of cane, great big field. And it's getting up frost time, and you've got to cut it before frost. We cut the last piece the night before it frosted and hauled it in. We was there a month and a half, from 4 o'clock in the morning to way after dark every night. People came from all over the county, wearing, you know, on crutches, old people, they hadn't seen it in years. And every one of them criticized, you're not doing that right, you're not doing this right. But we made hundreds of gallons. That's the last I've ever seen made.
What'd you do with it?
Dad sold most of it. He's the one that made the profit out of that. About $3 a gallon or something like that, you know. Yeah, of course, a lot of people love it. They, country folks.
What then was the fascination with the surveying? Was there something?
I don't know. I just after high school, I helped a surveyor. They were relocating the Southern Railroad, because of Bill and Fontana Dam. You know, it used to go down to Tuckasegee, turn there, and go to Robbinsville. So they relocated it. There was also, it went down a ways and then up by Almond and up the Nantahala Gorge. So they relocated. They just did away with that part to Fontana, but relocated so you could go out to Almond a little straighter. And I worked with a surveyor in that. And I don't know, I just got to liking the job. There's all kinds of new things that I didn't know about. They were building the road, and they, I don't know where they got this, but they would drill what they call a coyote hole back in the rock, where it's Rock Mountain. It's a circle, about 3 feet across. They drill in there, and they'd blow it out with dynamite, and they'd drill on back and blow out more and clear it out, and they'd get back, and then they'd tee off in each direction, get back about 30 feet, 40, tee off in each direction about 50 feet, the same kind of hole. Once they got that all cleaned out, then they packed it full of black powder, full. They'd pack, say, 3 feet and then a couple of feet of dirt and rocks, you know, run the line out. And then you'd get about a mile away on top of the mountain with a battery, and you'd blow that, and hear the whole mountain would go. And we had to go survey that and keep them straight with respect to how they were drilling their hole. That's one of the things we did. Most folks never heard of a coyote hole blowing a whole mountainside off, but I saw it happen. I don't guess it'd allow it today, but it got things done.
What did people think of the creation of the Smoky Mountain Park, the government taking their land?
Well, the government didn't take much land. They took their hunting land, they took their cattle land, but as far as ownership, there wasn't much of that. Most of it was bought up. But when I was growing up, there was no park. Of course, the mountains are there. Mm-hmm. But we hunted, bear hunted, coon hunted, rabbit hunting, whatever. Not much deer hunting, because there were not many deer in the Smokies. No hog hunting. Those were confined pretty well to Graham County at that time. Now they're all over the Smokies in Macon County. Some turkey hunting, wild turkeys, but there weren't many left. But we did a lot of that. And people, you know, these, what they call these balls, top of mountains that are flat, that have grass, I guess it's above the timber line, and it's an excellent pasture for cattle. So people pastured their cattle on those balls. And Anders Ball, which is southwest of Clingman's Dome and of the gap, the newfound gap that you go through to Tennessee, my dad had cattle over there. And I remember when I was 6 years old, I walked in there with him. They had to carry salt to them and just check on them. And they'd go and spend the day talking to people from Tennessee and friends, you know, from all over the country. They'd come there. I remember getting up way before daylight, and we carried a little lunch with us, and went over there and salted the cattle and talked a long time. Then walked back, got back about midnight, you know, back to the house. That was a long, but we used it for that purpose. Now, I didn't hear much resistance, but I was so small that I wasn't really aware of what was going on with respect to it. I know the man that, Horace Kephart, that really spearheaded the drive to get it done, one of the principal people. I knew him. I'd see him on the street. He didn't know me, but he wrote Our Southern Highlanders, which is a very, very fine, very fine book. It's he flatters us a bit, to tell you the truth, but it's still a good book. And I remember I'd see him near the courthouse there in Bryan City. I'd be walking to school, and I'd see him across the way. He wore leather leggings sometimes, like they wore in the war, and a broad-rimmed hat, and he's distinctive. You could see him. Somebody told me who he was. I remember when he got killed, 31, I guess it was. He'd been up to Cherokee. He went to Bryan City because he was a librarian out of St. Louis, which is the best library that far west. And about age 42, he left. He had five or six children. His wife, he never got back together. She moved back to New York, where she's from, and he came to Bryson City, and he was an alcoholic, and he kept it up to some degree. But he'd gone up to Cherokee, he and a rider from Atlanta, a friend of his, in a taxi, and they were coming back, and maybe the taxi driver drunk a little something. I don't know. They wrecked their Governor's Island Bridge, ran off, and killed the two of them. But he was one of those pushing for it, and I didn't hear much resistance. Down through the years, of course, they didn't pay much attention. If they wanted to go back in there and hunt or what they did, they kept on doing it, hunting ginseng, so not in recent years, but back then. Mm-hmm. And I kind of looked at it as my own, too. I walked over it. Remember the gaps. I remember there's a spring right under the top of a mountain called Cold Spring Knob, which is now in the park. You'll be on the Sharp Top, up Lands Creek, Deep Creek. And that water, it'll break your teeth. It's so cold. It's almost right out of the top of the mountain. How it does that, I don't know. But somebody would always have a gourd dipper hanging there. And somebody had gotten a piece of holler wood and stuck it back so it'd pour out. You just take the dipper and get you a drink of water. I always drank some of it and went by. It's just habit, you know. It's pure, but cold. something else.
Well, how did you decide to go back to college? You went to then Western Carolina.
Well, I kept those four of us who went over there. The other three didn't go back. And in fact, I don't know that any of them ever went any further in college at all, but I just got to thinking that I had the GI Bill, and I'd gone to Franklin, and I'd worked first in a lumber mill, Ziegler lumber mill there. I worked on the deck, rolling logs down for them to saw them, things like that. And then I got a job with the Forest Service. That's when we surveyed over in Nantahala and all over the place over there. So.